I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. This is the time of year across the country when fathers and mothers and teachers and students gather for the annual ritual of commencement.
Fellow members of the class of 2005, I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. It took me nearly 2 years to decide on a major.
We shall now present the candidates for degrees.
Mr. President,
Provost.
And finally, we are thinking about the future. The word commencement means, of course, a beginning. We are now at a new crossroads. Where to go? What to do?
I hereby confer upon you the degrees that you have earned, in token of which you will be granted diplomas.
Today marks the end of one chapter in our lives, and tomorrow is a new page entirely. Congratulations, class of 2005.
Well, as familiar as all those words seem, the working world, that new page ahead, may not be the one that most of us have been taught to anticipate. The writer Daniel Pink says there will always be work for doctors and lawyers and investment bankers, but that it might be time to pause and reconsider career paths that lead into business and medicine and law. Daniel says he's watching a shift from the information age into something he calls the conceptual age, a time when creativity is likely to count more than computing skills. Well, what do you think about that? Is it fantasy to imagine a time when corporate headhunters come chasing those with a fine arts degree? Are you seeing this shift into the conceptual age? And are we really ready to tell our children to skip the MBA and go for that degree in philosophy instead? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Daniel Pink explains these ideas in a new book. It's called A Whole New Mind, and he's joining us today from a studio in New York. Daniel, thanks for being with us.
Dick, thank you very much for having me. It's great to be on the program.
If I were to put you up on that commencement podium, what's the line you'd be delivering to graduates then?
I would tell graduates that the advice that their parents gave them about becoming accountants or lawyers or engineers or programmers as a way to achieve some measure of middle-class security and economic prestige might be the wrong advice, that in the labor market that they're going to be operating in over the course of their careers, they need to use a very different set of abilities, the abilities of lawyers and accountants and engineers. Those, they're still necessary, but the point of differentiation, the fault line between who's going to make it and who's not, is going to be mastery of a set of abilities we often haven't taken seriously enough in this country.
Now, you've got people's hands shaking all over the nation as they try and figure out what's wrong with the old paradigm. What are the jobs that you are saying people should be looking for? What is the kind of study you're talking about?
Well, it's important here to understand that the argument that I'm making is an argument rooted in facts, in data, in evidence, and what's going on. I myself happen to be a fairly left-brain, analytical kind of guy. I mean, I went to law school, of all things, listening to my parents' advice. But there's enormous amounts of evidence out there that we're in the midst of this shift. And there are three things that are shifting us in this new direction. That is, making a certain set of abilities logical, linear, analytical, computer-like, SAT-like abilities necessary but no longer sufficient, and the scales are tilting so that a different set of abilities, artistry, empathy, inventiveness, seeing the big picture, are really becoming the most valuable abilities in the economy. And the three forces, which we can talk about if you'd like, are abundance, that is a growing wealth in society, growing material standard of living in society, Asia, that is the offshoring of routine white-collar work, and also automation, that is the automating of certain kinds of white-collar work.
So the information age then really is coming to an end?
Yeah, I think it is. I think we're in the last gasps of it, really. That is, in the last gasp of the way to get ahead, the last gasp of an era in this country where the way to get ahead was to develop exclusively these kind of left-brain, logical, SAT spreadsheet abilities. Today, those abilities fundamentally are necessary but no longer sufficient because a lot of those abilities can get done cheaper overseas and faster by computers. And again, Dick, we've seen this movie before. This is what happened in many respects in the transition from the industrial age to the information age. We found that certain kinds of manufacturing work, certain kinds of routine manufacturing work, can get done cheaper overseas and faster by machines. means. And what's happening now is that it's certain kinds of professions, or more important, certain kinds of abilities, that is, abilities that are, and here is the watchword for all of you graduates to answer your initial question. The one thing to run screaming away from is any kind of work that is routine, that can be reduced to a script, to a spec sheet, to a set of instructions where you're given a set of rules and have to find the right answer. That kind of work, and that's the kind of work that requires brain power, it's certain kinds of accounting, certain kinds of computer programming, certain kinds of financial analysis. Fundamentally, over time, that kind of work is going to get done overseas for a lot less or by computers a lot faster.
So let me sit you down in the high school guidance counselor's chair and ask you what you would tell a student to sign up for. What should people, I mean, if we're saying that kids still ought to go to college, what are the courses that in fact play to this nonlinear, intuitive, emotional right brain side that you're saying is the future?
Well, you need to have the foundation, obviously, in analytic reasoning and literacy and numeracy. That's just table stakes to even play in this game. But I think the more important thing to ask for a student to ask him or herself is, what do you love to do? What is your passion? What is the thing that you would do even if they didn't pay you? Because I think that those kinds of abilities, the abilities that people do out of a sense of intrinsic motivation, are the sorts of abilities that are increasingly becoming more valuable in society. And so I would say, you know, develop a design literacy. Understand the importance of storytelling. Again, in a world of ubiquitous facts, finding facts has relatively little value. What matters more is the ability to put those facts in context and deliver them with emotional impact, and that's what story does. I would ask them, do what you love to do, because I think that has returns regardless of what you decide to do. So if you become an accountant, and I really do believe that over the long haul, accountants in this country are this century's blue-collar workers, that you should not tell your kid to become an accountant because people overseas can do it cheaper, and software like TurboTax and TaxCut can do it faster, and most people, God bless them, don't become accountants out of a sense of love of accounting or intrinsic motivation. If you do happen to love accounting and you want to go into it because you see a majesty in making the two sides of a balance sheet come together, that's fantastic. You're going to be a good accountant. But going dutifully into a job like that, I think, is terrible, terrible advice that a parent can give to a child. Like what they should be telling kids is, find out what you love to do, find out what you're great at, and do that. And also, do something that people overseas can't do cheaper, and that computers can't do faster, and then another factor here, that also satisfies, which this sounds like a dark and gloomy tale, but the truth is that this country is enormously well off in material terms. The standard of living in this country is breathtaking. That's why there's a premium when consumers have so many choices on these kind of non-rational features, design, aesthetic, spirituality, emotion.
Let me just stop you there, because this whole point about design, in fact, listening along to our conversation, is a man who is the Assistant Provost for Academic Affairs at the Rhode Island School of Design. Jay Coogan is joining us for a couple of moments. Jay, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Can you give us something of a real-world reality check on this? Are there any headhunters at the gates of RISD right now?
In fact, they've been here all spring, so there are definitely headhunters at the gates of RISD.
What are they looking for?
Well, they're looking for a lot of what Daniel's describing. They're looking for people with strong conceptual skills, able to think on their feet, people who are engaged in working with raw materials and ideas, that have the ability to see new relationships between those materials and ideas.
Okay, connect these people with the working world that we understand. Where do those design people wind up?
Well, ironically, they wind up at places you wouldn't expect. You know, I was out at General Motors about 7 years ago, and they were recruiting sculptors to come and work for General Motors. So they wind up in places like General Motors. A lot of them also because of the kind of entrepreneurial spirit that pervades art and design schools, end up running their own businesses.
Well, wait a second. The entrepreneurial spirit at a design school is something relatively new, too. I mean, wasn't it just a place where people used to go and get a degree, an MFA or something?
Well, it is definitely changed. Our students are seeking a degree based on art and design skills, but they're also very interested in the kind of business skills that go along with that so that they can package those things together and have the ability to be kind of masters of their own universe.
Let me just see if I can be a little bit more specific here. So GM comes to the Rhode Island School of Design and says they want what? The top three in the industrial design class? Or who are they looking for?
They're actually looking for sculptors because they're looking for people who understand the expressive ability of form making. They're also looking for industrial designers too, but they're looking for a different type of mind and a different approach to the type of market that they're having to put their cars into.
Daniel Pink, you're sitting there in New York going bingo.
Well, I mean, let me give a little bit of the backdrop here. This goes to the point about abundance. In 100 years ago in this country, a car, an automobile, was a rich person's toy. Today in America, you have now more automobiles than there are licensed drivers. That is, there's a greater than 1-to-1 ratio between cars and people who can drive them. So in that kind of world of abundance, the only way a car maker can stand out is not through the functional features, because you know what? Just about anybody in America can find a car that'll get them from point A to point B. And so you have, I mean, GM is a terrific example, because GM, one of the top leaders of General Motors, a guy named Bob Lutz, says that GM is in the art business. And when GM is in the art business, we're all in the art business.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join us as we take this a little bit further. I'll take this moment to say thanks to Jay Coogan for being with us. Jay, it's nice to hear from you.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Jay Coogan is Associate Provost for Academic Affairs at the Rhode Island School of Design. But Connection listeners, are you ready for this? Are you ready to tell your son or daughter to skip the MBA and go for the MFA? Is that where not only the professional excitement and interesting jobs of the future are, but is there a living in that? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Listening to The Connection, I'm Dick Gordon. Daniel Pink is my guest. He spends a lot of time thinking about how this country works, how people in this country work, where the jobs are and where they're going to be. You'll remember his earlier bestseller, Free Agent Nation. He's got a new book. It's called A Whole New Mind, Moving from the Information Age to the Conceptual Age. And our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to start in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Rick's on the line. Hello, Rick.
Morning. What a great show.
Is he right?
Right on. Absolutely right on. Class of 2005, watch out. I think what's happening, though, is that we're moving into a new place. It's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take some time. But I think the point that Daniel raised is really the point when you were talking about automobiles is a point of commoditization. Everything's being commoditized. Everything is really the same. Look at Microsoft Word or virtually any software package. Microsoft is trying to sell its latest Word software application. And what is it giving me that the last one gave? What is it giving me that's new? Well, I can translate into Farsi. Well, that's terrific, but I don't really need that. Why am I going to buy that? So what Microsoft, what the software companies, financial services firms are looking for people to have is a more creative edge, which is not an oxymoron. But you have to be careful of what I'd call the flake factor. Mm. When you use terms like imaginative, conceptual, the feeling on the part of management is when you say that someone's imaginative, it means that it's synonymous with flaky. Well, the fact is that if you are able to come up with a solution that no one else could see, a person who is, say, focused on a more quantitative side of the business model, then that gives you the edge, and that decommoditizes. It takes away that differentiates whatever it is, a product that you're trying to market.
Daniel, what do you think as you're listening to Rick here?
I think Rick makes several good points. The first is, I mean, I think he's right about the flake factor. I mean, I think it's there's a perception out there, and there's also the reality. If you are only good at these kind of right brain things, design and artistry and empathy, and you have no quantitative skills and no analytical abilities, you're not going to make it very far. What you need is, which is why the title of this book is A Whole New Mind, rather than, you know, get jiggy on the right side of the brain. It really is a matter of this holistic approach where you combine the analytical and the creative empathetic, but the creative empathetic is really the first among equals. I mean, I think, and then you see this kind of convergence. We saw it with Jay Coogan from RISD, where these design students are actually learning business schools, and now you also have MBA programs that are really in a world of hurt in many cases right now, who are are going out and doing joint programs with art and design colleges, again, to combine both the artistic and empathic, but also the quantitative. And all, and the reality of business today, as Rick is saying, is that things become commoditized so quickly that there's a premium on doing something new and inventive. And that's why I think that the kids in this class of 2005 are going to flourish as designers of all type, as product development specialists of all type, but not so much in the routine kind of purely analytical work as accountants and financial analysts.
And Rick, where do you fit here? Are you a frustrated engineer, or what's your own perspective on this?
No, it's been an interesting journey. I was an English lit and history major in college, and I went into investment banking. How did I fit into that? Well, it got me going, but I was able to.
Did you have an edge over the other people who came in with their MBAs, though?
No, I don't think I did at the time, and I found that it was actually more of a long-term success thing. Where, as an investment banker, it took me longer to get up to speed because my quantitative abilities were not what theirs were. But I learned it over time, and having learned that, now I've got both sides firing, you know, at full speed.
This is actually something that I wanted to hear Daniel go one step further on, because Daniel, if I use the cliche of thinking outside the box to try and define what we're talking about here, what I understand from Rick and from you is that you have to know the inside of the box. In fact, you might have to have that engineering degree in order to be the kind of engineer who does think outside the box, right?
Maybe. I'm not sure about the engineering degree. I think that a lot of engineering knowledge becomes obsolete very quickly.
Okay.
I think having the broader ability to see systems in engineering, or to see the big picture, or understand the basics is essential. But any engineer who isn't nimble, who doesn't have a sense of inventiveness, and also, in a business sense, also isn't empathic and has, you know, these fantastic so-called soft skills is going to be is going to be struggling. But I do think that there is, if you go back to the degrees, there are a certain set of college majors or a certain set of kids today who are walking across the stage and grabbing a diploma, and they've majored in anthropology or philosophy or linguistics, and which a category that I call what are you going to do with that majors. And I think that there's now a growing premium on what are you going to do with that majors, because even CEOs, there was a study of CEOs last month where they said that to CEOs in this graduation season, what do you advise people to major in if they want to follow your path and become head of a company? And they said almost to a person, liberal arts.
Huh. You used the word empathic. How does that word fit in here?
Oh, I think that empathy is, I mean, among the, I in the course of my research, I've identified what I think are six key abilities that are going to matter the most. And one of them is empathy. Empathy is enormously important on a number of dimensions. First, it makes life better. You're a better, more interesting, more satisfied person if you develop your innate capacity for empathy. The second is that empathy turns out to be a job skill that is difficult to outsource and difficult to automate. And you see this now in some professions that we often don't think of as intrinsically empathic. A good example is sales. Okay? Salespeople, good salespeople, test off the charts on empathy. Why? Because good salespeople aren't hucksters who are trying to stick you with something you don't need, but they can look at a customer, look at a prospect, and really see the world through their eyes, feel the world through their hearts, and understand what their needs are. You see it now also in the field of medicine. There are medical schools, and think about medical school. Medical school is really the bastion of this kind of left brain, high SAT, muscle flexing approach to intellect. Medical schools now are testing students in empathy. There's an instrument called the Jefferson Scale of Physician Empathy that measures students in empathy, and they're finding some very interesting things from that. One of them is that high scores on this empathy index correlate very tightly to patient outcomes. Surprise, surprise. What doesn't correlate so well with patient outcomes? MCAT scores. Because again, once you've passed the hurdle and have the left brain capacity to be a physician, what makes you a good physician are these other sorts of things. And so in these measures of empathy, they're showing that generalists score better than hospital-based specialists, that nurses score higher than physicians, and, interestingly enough, that women score higher than men.
1-800-423-8255. Back to the phones to Middleton, Massachusetts. Ian's with us. Hi, Ian.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my phone call.
Yeah.
I was calling because I wish what you guys were saying was true, because I'm in my early 30s, and when I was in school in the 90s, everyone said, you know, do liberal arts, you'll learn how to think, and then go from there. And
what did you study, Ian?
I was actually a philosophy major.
All right.
And I went back to school a couple of years ago to do IT because I didn't have any skills. And there's not one person I know that did liberal arts who's in their 30s that thinks it was a good idea. We all wish we were engineers because, I don't know, it just, when is this going to happen, this transition? And I think that the basic core skills are so specialized now that you have to have them. You have to pick one and then go from there. I'm not saying you can't be creative.
No, I think it's a really good question because Daniel's whole thesis does raise the question, how do you connect the liberal arts people with those areas of expertise, with those career paths that we've been taught to think were kind of closed off to anyone with a degree in sociology or philosophy? Daniel, what about it?
Yeah, well, let me ask, Ian, what do you do now, if I can ask?
I'm IT.
You're in IT, and do you enjoy it?
No, it's boring.
And what do you think about your long-term career prospects in IT?
Well, I think it'll be consistent. Will I have a creative outlet, you know, from it? Probably not, but I know I'll have a job. So, you know, that's kind of my focus right now.
Yeah.
Just having that job, but I'd love to do something more interesting and creative, but I just don't feel I have that option at the moment.
Well, I mean, I think Ian makes a good point. What we have here in this country, I mean, you have actually a decline in the number of IT jobs in this country. Part of it is cyclical. That is, the bottom fell out of the dot-com economy. But part of it is secular. That is, over the long term, certain kinds of IT jobs are inevitably going to go overseas. They already have. Getting to your question, Dick, how does these majors like philosophy or anthropology or English literature connect to these actual jobs? Well, I think that in some ways, the more specialized a job is, the more perilous it becomes. Now, again, that seems counterintuitive, but I really think that's the case. And what you see now, especially in IT companies, is demand, and Ian, I'm curious what you think about this, is demand for these a certain type of manager who has both the technical skills but also has very strong abilities in kind of crossing boundaries, that is, working with, say, programmers in India, working with programmers in the United States, understanding the sales function, understanding the marketing function, understanding the technology as well. That's a very whole-minded thing, and I think that a liberal arts background gives you that, in part, that innate curiosity to wonder about how all the pieces fit together, but also an approach to understanding yourself and understanding your work that isn't siloed in a particular area of technical expertise, because that becomes outdated very, very quickly. There are programming languages that used to be $65,000 a year jobs that are basically useless today, and that's occurred in the space of 6 or 7 years.
No, I agree that you need to have a creative approach to problem solving, but these problems are very deep, and you have to have that specialized knowledge. And I think what's happened over the years is because technology has advanced so far that you really need to study something for a long time to fully understand. You can't solve a problem if you don't understand all the basics. And just getting the basics now, I think, takes a lot longer.
Ian, I want to just move along here. Philip Gardner's been listening in. He is director of the Collegiate Employment Research Institute at Michigan State University. Philip, it's nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Dick.
Tell me, as you listen to Ian trying to puzzle this out and Daniel explaining it and other people weighing in, where does it fit in the kind of research that you're doing? Are we really, in your view, also at that shift from an information age to something new, maybe the conceptual age?
Well, we're definitely in a shift, and it's always awkward going through a period of transition where nobody knows what it's really going to look like at one end, and they leave something that's very, very comfortable at the other. I don't know if it's, we call it a knowledge, we're still using knowledge because we're shifting from a linear problem solving to a non-linear critical thinking, which embodies most of what Daniel's talking about, all these characteristics is, and critical thinking problems are not the same. And this transition is very awkward. And we've got ourselves caught in using old paradigms to try to help guide people and...
When you look at Daniel's book, you'll see that he uses the Bureau of Labor Statistics, for example, and the kind of information that you're supposed to get from them about the state of the working world. And the point he makes, Philip, is that it's always out of date. It's always one generation off.
Well, with assumptions behind that, those data is that it doesn't account for labor substitution, outsourcing, higher education levels, and we just assume that everybody's going to be doing the same thing. Those people that leave are going to replace, and it's not true. And these things evolve, and they evolve much quicker than the way we collect data and how we change our categories we put people in.
So are you saying now to students, you've got to be a critical thinker, you've got to find some way to express your creativity or you're sunk?
We have to, because it takes a long time for institutions to catch up. We're still dealing with skills back from the 90s. I mean, Daniel wrote about them back in the 90s. We're still getting universities to start getting kids to have them, and now we're adding a whole bunch of different things on top of that. Though the nice thing about these skills is that they're already embedded if the faculty are aware that they and emphasize them. I think that's really important to know. These aren't things that are completely new. They just have to be emphasized in our educational process rather than the mastery rote in combination with mastery rote. We can't exclude one or the other, but we just tend to not to ignore these things and let a few of them, few students, trickle to the top and acquire them, or through serendipitous things or some focused effort if they match up with the right faculty member. But the body of students go through don't even aware that a lot of this kind of skills are out there. Opportunities to gain these skills are out there.
Daniel, is that your research showing you the same sort of thing, that the educational system's still not really adapted to this?
I think so, and I think Philip makes a very good point about just how slow-moving large systems are in their ability to adapt to this. But, I mean, even the Bureau of Labor Statistics will tell you that today in America, we have more people working in the fields of art, entertainment, and design than work as lawyers, accountants, or auditors. And even in some ways, the vocabulary becomes a little outdated, and you can see this in a previous shift. Let's take a manufacturing worker. We have this almost cartoonish notion of what a manufacturing worker is, and we still have, you know, one out of seven workers in this country is a manufacturing worker, even though we don't see that as a norm so much anymore. But the folks in manufacturing today are not, you know, turning wrenches on bolts one after another after another. If you go to a factory floor today in most industries, you will see robots and computers and people who are operating these machines who have degrees, associate degrees, or sometimes even bachelor's degrees. So the content of a manufacturing job is very different from the past. And I think that in many ways the content, we're still going to have accountants, some. We're still going to have financial analysts, some. Right. We are still inevitably going to have lawyers. But the content of those jobs and who flourishes in those jobs is going to shift more toward these creative, empathic, big picture sorts of abilities.
Let me just go back to Philip Gardner on this. I know that there'd be people wondering here, you know, is this whole right brain creative thing, can you teach this, or is it also in some senses like you've got it or you don't have it?
Well, I don't know. No, you can develop it, but I don't know if you can teach to it. What you have to do is put students in positions where they can are forced to use those kind of abilities and capacities. They could be in class, out of class, and then acknowledge them and begin to use them in reflection with them to understand how they utilize them.
That's a big change in the way that people are taught, though. That's not 50 people sitting in an auditorium taking notes, is it?
It's a significantly different way, yep. And I would agree with you, and it's really hard. And fortunately, you know, Daniel's right. The liberal arts educated kids have somewhat of an advantage on that, but you got to be cautious going down that path, because we put out a lot of liberal arts degreed that don't have that kind of interaction with faculty and things. It's truly the liberally educated folk that we're talking about, and so you got to be careful on terminology there. Most kids don't have that opportunity to do that.
Quick last word from you, Philip. We got our advice to graduates from Daniel. What are you telling graduates today?
Well, I'm telling you what you should do, what you really like to do, and hopefully you've majored in something that you really enjoyed getting up every morning, going to class about, and that it's not the first job. We're all hung up about getting that first job, and it's like couple people said, it's the second, third, fourth jobs where all these skills start kicking in, and you need to look ahead and be position yourself for those jobs and not so worry about exactly where you fall in the first job.
Yeah, it's a little bit about the free agent nation as well as a whole new mind. Philip, I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Philip Gardner is Director of Collegiate Employment Research Institute at Michigan State University. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like your thoughts on what's happening in the education and working world, and is there, in fact, lots of space for those with the philosophy degrees and the sculptors? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Daniel Pink is with me this hour from a studio in New York. He's written a book called A Whole New Mind, talking about moving from the information age to the conceptual age. We're interested in your thoughts on that. Does it work? Does it fit the kind of work that you're looking at, the kind of education that you're looking at? 1-800-423-TALK to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Staples is joining us. Hi, Staples. What do you think?
Here's what I think. The comment that somebody quoted, a few minutes ago from a GM officer saying we're in the art business, sort of set me off. You know, GM is a large entity that is in big trouble because their cars, by and large, are bad cars. I buy Japanese cars because they're great cars. You know, the Japanese have, for the better part of two decades, now been making great cars, not because they were thinking with their left, right, or center brain, because they engaged somehow or another in very basic, elegant, good design, by and large. You know, if I can't drive a car 200,000 miles, I don't think it's a very good car, and I've been able to drive their cars 200,000 miles. You know, we talk about digital conversion.
Staples, just while we stay with the cars for a minute here, when you're talking about choosing one car over another, are you saying that you make that choice because it's mechanically better? You use the word elegant. I mean, are you also choosing the car because it looks better?
If the car is not engineered so that it is a functional and cost-efficient device for transporting me from point A to point B, I don't give a damn what it looks
so
like.
So you're saying GM is not in the art business, or you just don't care about that side of...
No, I'm saying that because conceptually they think they're in the art business when they first ought to be paying attention to making functional devices to transport people. If they then moved into the art business, cool. Would I rather have a cool-looking car than a lousy-looking car? Sure, but right now, this whole discussion assumes in some sense that we have exhausted traditional approaches to simple, elegant engineering. Mm-hmm. If you were talking about educating people in different modalities because it will contribute to basic engineering or design or functionality principles, cool. But, you know, sometimes I get the impression that you're talking about, okay, we've been there, done that, exhausted that way of approaching things. And the fact of the matter is, you know, my phone call got dropped three or four times here while I was waiting for you guys because the cell phone system sucks. American cars suck. You know, so all I'm saying is...
It's a good point, and I think it's clear. The assumption, Daniel, that, you know, stuff works and we've got lots of it so we can concentrate on how it looks. You can challenge that, as Staples is.
I think Staples makes a very good point. I mean, from the perspective of someone buying a product or a service, you want first and foremost functionality. If it doesn't work, you're not going to buy it no matter how useful it is. However, I do think that we've achieved a great deal in engineering. If you look at the automobile industry, there has not been a breakthrough in automobile engineering since the invention of the internal combustion engine. I mean, we're still using the same kind of engine we used, you know, 80 or 90 years ago. Now, GM, I'm not going to defend GM because GM is in serious financial trouble. But one reason that it's in trouble is that it took the eye off the art ball. GM for the last two or three years thought it was in the 0% financing business, which is not a viable business. And so GM the guy who they put in charge to try to rehabilitate GM, or at least the number two really, to try to rehabilitate GM around better cars, cooler cars, cars that work and cars that are great, is this fellow Bob Lutz, who made the comment about GM being in the art business.
But is that just sales? Because it's more than that.
No, I don't think it's. I think the comment or the underlying principle.
I guess the comment. I mean, by saying, well, look at the design of what we've got, it's better, even if our cars aren't. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I think that GM would recognize, I think Lutz would recognize that some of its cars are not as good as they could be, both on the engineering side and on the design side. And so GM will, you know, it is, as Staples is saying, it is business 101. You got to have stuff that works.
Yep.
And if the stuff that works looks cool, provides some kind of aesthetic, emotional value on top of that, then you're going to win in the marketplace.
1-800-423-8255 to Durham, North Carolina. Danielle's with us. Hi, Danielle.
Hello. I had 2 points. One is that I'm 30, and I'm a huge cheerleader for my liberal arts education. It's the best thing that I've ever done for my career. Also, I really...
Are you working, Danielle?
I am working. I'm an architect.
Okay.
And that goes to my second point, which is that I think that architects have been trained both in thinking outside the box and in analytical skills for years, and yet... the man from RISD didn't talk about how many people were knocking down the door of the architecture department, in thinking about these skills. I don't think that, I mean, I think while America, you know, appreciates architecture, I don't think that they know the possibilities of what architects can do, in both the field of analytical thinking and in, being creative. I don't think it's being exploited.
You know, though, Danielle, as I think about it... For as long as I've paid attention to architecture, it has been one of those rare professions that does draw in the importance of the technical understanding alongside the ability to be a creative thinker, though, no?
Right. No, I believe that that's true. I just don't... I think that while there are many people who... I mean, I went through a dry spell in getting a job, and I think that there are a lot of places that architects... People who are trained in architecture could be benefiting the society in other places. Mm-hmm. Like, why aren't there an architect on local governments talking about, you know, the way that cities should be run? Why aren't there architects, you know, in corporations? I mean, why aren't architects mayors or governors?
Yeah, Daniel, why aren't they?
I'm all for it. I'd vote for an architect for mayor over a lawyer. I think Danielle makes a very, very good point. Architecture is a very, very whole-minded profession. It is about function, and it's also about some form of transcendence and beauty. And what's curious about that, we were talking earlier in the program about education system. There are some models out there with an approach to education that teaches the broad array of skills, the literacy and numeracy and these more right-brain skills as well, through the prism of architecture and design. And there's a charter school in Philadelphia that I write about in the book called CHAD, the Charter High School for Architecture and Design. And it takes students from some of the worst neighborhoods in Philadelphia and gives them a design-centered, architecture-centered curriculum. Everything is built around those two fields. And what this school is doing is extraordinary. And so you have kids graduating from this school, kids whose parents might not have even graduated from high school, who are graduating this year. They have a kid in this year's class who's going to RISD, a kid in this year's class who's going to the California College of the Arts. And so I think that there is, as Danielle is saying, Danielle probably didn't become an architect because she thought it was some kind of great career move or her parents pressured her into doing it. She had some kind of intrinsic interest in that. And if we get people to develop their intrinsic interest, we're finding that the things that people do out of a sense of intrinsic motivation increasingly are having an economic value in society.
I'm going to ask you to give us one more definition because I think it's useful in taking this another step, and that's your use of the word symphony here. Can you take us through the importance of that?
Right. Well, symphony is... You know, in the course of my research, as I mentioned earlier, I've identified 6 key abilities that I think are going to matter the most. And one of them is what I call symphony. And symphony is the ability to see the big picture and also to combine disparate things into something the world didn't know it was missing. And that turns out to be this capacity for inventiveness and big picture thinking turns out to be so, so, so enormously valuable in any type of business. Let me give you one example of that. Dan Goleman, who wrote the book, wonderful book, Emotional Intelligence, mm-hmm. talks about a study where they took the star performers from 12 or 15 companies and gave them this whole battery of cognitive tests to try to crack the code of what made someone a star performer. And it turned out analytic reasoning, vocabulary, math, all that sort of stuff, there was no correlation. The only thing where there was a correlation and a very strong correlation was on this capacity for big picture thinking, the ability to look at a welter of information and detect what's important and what's not, to see patterns. And those are and that ability is becoming in many ways to use a phrase from the late 1990s, a killer app in business.
Let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina for a call from Robert. Robert, thanks for calling. What do you think?
I actually, I really agree with the guest, and so that's why I called in. I'm a philosophy major. I graduated from West Virginia University in 1998, and in order to get my first job, I used to do web design sort of on the side, and I taught myself how to do that just from reading books, and I feel like my philosophy major, it helped me. I tell people it made me like the Karate Kid, because when I was reading Socrates and Spinoza and Leibniz, I wasn't going to use it in the real world, but it sort of taught me, I was learning how to punch and kick. In other words, I was learning how to be able to take something, understand it, and sort of become a, you know, maybe a master of it. And so I went from the, when I did the web design, that's how I hooked up with a television station. And when they were about to eliminate my job, when sort of the web kind of crashed, they said, well, can you sell something? So then I had to become a salesperson. I did some reading, and that's what I do now. I mean, I've moved to a bigger station here in Raleigh. I do sales.
Are you good at it, Robert?
I'm extremely good at it. And it's, you know, it's the sort of situation where I have to learn about the furniture business to sell a furniture client. One of my clients is General Motors, so I need to learn about the car business. You know, one of my clients is a local car dealer. I need to know his business. I need to know, you know, you have to be able to pick all that stuff up through research on the Internet, through reading, and I really feel like my degree in philosophy has prepared me for that.
There's can I ask you to just be a little bit more specific about that? Take me back to the late 90s when you were still in school and still reading the works of the great thinkers, and see if you can draw a line between that moment and where you are. Was it just that you figured out then that if you didn't know something, you could go and find it out? I mean, yes. Is it that simple?
For me, that's really what I thought it was. It wasn't something I knew I could do, but you know, when you're digging into an essay by someone and you have to pull out the arguments and you have to think of the different things that might make it right, that might make it wrong, you know, that helps you, I think, in anything. You know, when I had to learn web design, I was able to start at point A and teach myself because I was able to understand it clearer. I think it makes things like that really simple when you have a strong ability to reason critically. And that's what philosophy helped me.
What do you think, Daniel?
I think it makes sense. I actually wish that I had thought of that Karate Kid line, too. I do think that
there'll
we
be another edition, no doubt.
Yeah, really. There's a new subtitle, A Whole New Mind, The Karate Kid Economy. I do think that's right, and I do think that kind of nimbleness that Robert is talking about, the ability to cross boundaries, the ability to do different things, the ability to reinvent, I think that is so fundamentally important in this kind of economy, and you need to be nimble and responsive. But a lot of it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, is intrinsic motivation. You can tell, and I think, Robert, are you still online?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Yeah, do you enjoy what you do?
Oh, I love it.
Okay, so there you go. I mean, Robert is doing something in part out of a sense of intrinsic motivation. And things we do out of intrinsic motivation tend to be things that we do well and that we enjoy. And a lot of the abilities that I think are mattering most in the economy today, design and story and this ability of symphony and empathy and even play, are things we do out of a sense of intrinsic motivation. You have no doubt in, you know, big cities around America this weekend, there will be accountants who are in their garage painting landscapes. There will be lawyers, you know, in their offices writing a screenplay. But I guarantee you will not find someone who is a sculptor for a day job and at night for fun is doing somebody else's taxes. That the sorts of things that we do out of a sense of intrinsic motivation are increasingly getting a greater sense of economic reward.
It's interesting because as I listen to you going through all those things where Robert succeeds, where other people you think in the future will succeed, almost every skill that you're describing there, Daniel, is a skill that has to do with dealing with another person, some kind of interaction.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, interesting. And I think that ability to if you look at something like sales, the work that Robert is in, I mean, sales, it turns out there's certain kinds of sales that you can automate. So you can go online and buy something, and that's pure kind of functional, rational transaction. You don't need a human being for it. But at a certain level, sales is a very complex dance between two human beings, and it requires a remarkably sophisticated set of abilities. And I think it's true of all these things. And that's why, Dick, we were talking about empathy earlier. You look at a designer. Great designers are very, very empathic, because in order to design something for another human being, you have to put yourself into that person's shoes. You have to see the world through that person's eyes. What's it going to feel like to use this product? What's it going to feel like to see this particular type font? And so that ability for empathy is just the most important thing about empathy is that it makes life better. It's a good way to lead a life. But the happy coincidence here is that it turns out to be economically more valuable today than ever before.
Let's go to Cambridge, Massachusetts for a call from Dustin. Dustin, thanks for calling. What do you think?
So I just wanted to comment on earlier there was a quote that said something about the CEO saying that, you know, study liberal arts. And I think I agree with a lot of what's been said here, that it's very valuable in helping to gain what I would consider to be just a much broader perspective on the world, which enables people to be effective, like, in the job place. But I think the thing that's important to think about, though, is that not everybody's going to be a CEO, and not everybody's going to reach the upper echelons of management. And I think a lot of that is just there's not enough room for that, and not everybody's fully capable of that. And so I think it's difficult for people when they're assessing what they want to study as an undergraduate, and I'm one of these people who now regrets not having a liberal arts education as an undergraduate. You know, I think that it's difficult for people to assess at that point in time whether or not they're going to be capable of going on and being that successful, or whether or not they need to try to find some sort of tangible skill right away.
But Daniel, I think a lot of what you're saying is that it doesn't necessarily have to come on a sheepskin. It doesn't have to come from school, right?
No. I think that in a way that people major in liberal arts because they find it enjoyable and they're curious about it. I'm curious, Dustin, what did you study in college?
Oh, he's left us.
He's gone. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I think that those kinds of it doesn't really matter what you study in school. And I want to pick up on one thing that Dustin said, which is sort of an undercurrent of sometimes in these discussions, which is that some people are just not capable of doing these right brain things, these design and story and empathy and symphony and play and meaning. That's you're either born with it or you're not. And I don't buy that at all. I think that these abilities, especially things like design and story and symphony, are fundamentally human abilities. I think they're part of what makes us human. And to say that people can't get a design sensibility or get a capacity for story or develop a capacity for symphony and inventiveness, to me, is as wrong-headed as some people said 60, 70 years ago when we were moving from a factory economy to an information economy that, oh, you know what? Everybody can't go to high school. Everybody can't be literate. Everybody can't be numerate. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody, and no one would say that today. It doesn't mean that everybody, when we say everybody can be literate and numerate, that everybody can be Toni Morrison or that everybody can be Albert Einstein. But everybody can develop those basic capacities, and it's the same with this set of right brain abilities.
Daniel, I thank you for being with us on the program today. It's fun.
Dick, it's been a pleasure.
Daniel Pink, author of A Whole New Mind, Moving from the Information Age to the Conceptual Age. Earlier in the program, we talked with Philip Gardner, director of Collegiate Employment Research Institute at Michigan State University, and Jay Coogan, who's associate provost for academic affairs at the Rhode Island School of Design. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.